Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk about books, information, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. This week I'm very happy to have on the show Dan Cohen. He's the founding executive director of the Digital Public Library of America, which just had its first birthday since its launch back in April of 2013. He's also an historian and served in the Department of History and Art History at George Mason University, where he also directed for many years the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media, the media lab that brought us important and popular open source research and curatorial tools such as Zotero and Omica. He's with us today by telephone to talk about the DPLA. Hello, Dan.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you on the show. So the Digital Public Library of America is getting a lot of press recently, in part at least because of the anniversary. Just last week it was reviewed in the Times and the Washington Post both. And yeah. Although maybe at this point, you know, we can assume that most people who spend time online anyway have heard of the DPLA, it isn't quite a household term yet, maybe it's getting there. So I wonder if you could give us, just to begin, an overview of the project and of the project's mission.
Sure. Well, we, in fact, are in a process of letting everyone know about the DPLA because I think we have a lot to offer. And what we have to offer is, in fact, our project brings together the riches of America's libraries, archives, museums, and cultural heritage sites. And that means that we take openly available material from, at this point, approaching 1,300 contributing institutions from all 50 states across the nation, material that ranges from textual in nature, books and manuscripts, to images, photographs, artwork, and other kinds of material as well, audiovisual material. We bring that all together in one place at dp.la. It's a nice short URL, works on any device, mm-hmm. looks good on a phone or an iPad or a computer, whatever you're using. And you can find, at this point, over 7 million items from those almost 1,300 contributing institutions all in that one place. And they really range from materials from big places like the Smithsonian and very, very small places like rare materials from Red Wing, Minnesota in rural Goodhue County, Minnesota. So it really is kind of one-stop shopping, and you can find, again, millions of items there of all kinds and from all eras. And I think you'll find, if your audience hasn't visited there before, that there's a lot there for you to view, and all of it is open and free.
Yeah, and it's multimedia too, isn't it? It's not just text, as you say, but there are images and maps and that kind of thing.
We do. We have tens of thousands of maps. One of our contributing institutions, if you want to call it that, is David Rumsey, who's a rare map collector in California, and has donated tens of thousands of maps. There's really a historical map for almost every place that if you want to look up your town or city or state, you'll find an incredible Rumsey map that's fully digitized and ready to look at. You can zoom in. So maps are very, very popular on our site. And in fact, we have a map-based interface where you mm-hmm. can browse down even to the block level and find materials, because one of the key things we do is provide what's called geocoding. That is, we provide latitude and longitude for each item in the collection, and so you can find materials that way as well. So we also have audiovisual material, as I mentioned. We have 15,000 films at this point of all kinds, ranging from films made by the federal government mm-hmm. to local public radio station and public TV station materials, again, all found in one place.
Great. And then you also have applications that people can use associated with the website?
That's right. So one of the neat things about the DPLA is that it's not just a place to go to on the web at dp.la, but it is actually serves as what we like to call a platform. Mm-hmm. So all the material that we aggregate and bring together is then also made available to software developers worldwide who can create really innovative apps for education or entertainment, anything that they want out of the material that we've brought together. So just some examples so your audience can get a real sense of this. And you can see these applications on our website if you go to our app library, in the same way that they might go to the App Store if they've got an iPhone, or Google Play if they've mm-hmm. got an Android phone. We actually have, I think at this point, close to 20 apps. Okay, it's not 200,000 apps, but it's growing every month. Mm-hmm. And shows you some of the innovation of what people can do once library collections are digitized and then made available as part of a platform. So we have an app called OpenPix, mm-hmm. and this is an app for your smartphone where it uses the GPS signal on your phone to locate, obviously, where you are in the world. And then it will show you materials from the DPLA. Again, we make latitude and longitude available for all those items. And so you use this app called OpenPix, and as you walk around, let's say if you're in a city, it will show you historical photographs of buildings right that are right in front of you. It will show you materials if you're standing on the ground where a famous event took place. It will show you materials related to that event, whether it's images or books related to it. So it's a really fantastic kind of app. There's another app called Culture Collage, where if anyone from your audience has used Pinterest, it's mm-hmm. a kind of Pinterest way of using the DPLA, where it shows you thumbnail images from our collection for any matching search, and you can arrange those thumbnail images into a collage, as the name suggests, Culture Collage, and you can save those collages and share them with others. And we've had teachers use that app, for instance, to create little collages that their class can use, and then students can go in and look at the specific collage and then click through from the thumbnails to the full image that they want to look at. So another great way to use the collection. And again, there are a couple dozen other applications. I'd encourage the audience to take a peek at them.
Yeah, this is a very empowering kind of structure you have, isn't it? It's not a sort of one-way stream of information coming into you from various institutions and then going out to the public, but you're really trying to engage the public, and I see you have a kind of hub structure, which seems to me where most of your potential for growth as a network lies. You know, and I presume you use the word hub here because these aren't so much terminals as centers that spoke out into communities at the grassroots level.
Yeah. It's a very webby kind of model. You know, DPLA came out of a three-year planning process where different kinds of models were tossed out about how you build a national digital library. Mm-hmm. And some of those models were much more monolithic and weren't based on hubs or nodes or anything like that. But as you mentioned, what we're trying to do is actually to have hubs, which is a kind of fancy way of saying that across the country we have these centers, digital libraries out in regions and states, and those in turn go out and get materials from small and mid-sized places across their area. So I mentioned Minnesota earlier. We have a hub, it's actually a set of three institutions in Minnesota that mm-hmm. act as a hub there, University of Minnesota, Minitex, and the Minnesota Historical Society, all of them big institutions with a statewide reach, and they've gone out in turn to about 160 very small places, some of them mom-and-pop historical sites, to help them scan their material, to help them get data about their material into our system. And so it's a wonderful, I think, as you mentioned, sort of decentralized model where there is a point of access on the web at dp.la, but there's also a way that we're really using the power of the web to unite disparate materials.
Yeah, and is this a kind of growth model then, as well as an information distribution model? I mean, do you see this sparking or becoming bigger and gathering more information?
Yeah, so right now we only have these hubs, service hubs, in about 14, 15 states. Yeah. So we have another 35 states to go. And one of the really key things that we'll be doing over the next couple of years is to find more hubs across the nation so that everyone has an on-ramp. Every collection in the United States that wants to be a part of the DPLA has a local on-ramp that they can use to get to be a part of us.
And then in terms of the information you're gathering, then is there an emphasis on gathering collections at the local level so that basically you're drawing information in from your users and your users are your information providers, which is, the model that makes social media work, really, Facebook, Twitter, you name it. It allows them to grow exponentially very quickly.
Right. Well, a bit of a clarification is that I think in the long run, we would love to take in materials from, grandpa's shoebox of World War II photos in the attic, and that would be great. It's a little early for us to do that right now, so all the materials we have coming in are from some of them small institutions, but all of them, known institutions that if you're part of the community, for instance, in North Carolina, 52 public libraries that have historical collections are part of the DPLA. So they're coming in through trusted institutions. But having said that, it is very intriguing, and I love your idea to think into the future after we aggregate materials that are from these trusted institutions to also go out to the public and see what they have. And in fact, we have a great case of that happening in Europe right now with a kind of sister project in Europe called Europeana, which has pulled together millions of items from across Europe for the 100th anniversary of the First World War, which of course is this year, 2014. So looking back at 1914, they've had some of these public events using, again, the same kind of hub and spoke model, where they were able to pull together about 50,000 items from families across Europe that had, again, materials at home that they could bring on. So we're not there yet with the Digital Public Library of America because we're just a year old, but it's something that we really do look forward to in the years ahead.
It's a wonderful idea, you know, because you're combining the beauty of this kind of grassroots empowerment with a kind of traditional notion of organizing information. So it isn't just then, you know, Facebook, but there's some kind of organization going on, isn't there?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yes. And I think it's important also that your audience knows, you know, we are a nonprofit organization or a national nonprofit. So I think viewing us as a kind of trusted repository for this sort of content in the long run is, in some ways, it's in contrast to a lot of the kind of commercial services that are out there that people use and that we don't know if they'll be around in 10 years or even maybe one year in some cases.
Sure. This is a kind of project that must be exceedingly difficult to manage. And one of the things I expect you're managing here is expectations. It seems to me, you know, the more excited you can get people about the program, the more it will flower into something and really spread out exponentially. You know, since we're talking here about a network and a specific kind of network that's based on goodwill and a belief in the collective good of sharing. But on the other hand, you know, you don't want to deflate people by raising expectations and then not being able to deliver. So as a manager and director of the project, are you conscious of having to manage expectations on a grand level here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a very complicated project. I mean, in some ways, the model, which I think is the right one, this hubs model, it's obviously much more complex than if we were just a single institution. But the great advantage of it, and I think one of the most gratifying things of waking up every day and working on DPLA, is that it really is a large-scale collaboration. Yeah. As I like to say, it's really as much a social project as it is a technical project. And that makes it incredibly special. I mean, it means that there are thousands of people across the United States involved in DPLA. It's not just a thing that exists in Boston that is sort of reaching out on its own across the United States to pull things away from people. It's really, we are trying to coordinate something nationally. And I think that's a kind of a wonderful model, but you're right. It is absolutely more complex, and a lot of what I do is go around the country and, in a sense, do a kind of marketing job to say other people should be joining in our effort, and we've been gratified by the response to that.
But it isn't just marketing, though. It's community organizing, it seems to me.
Yes, no, absolutely right. That's right. Yeah. Community by community. And now that we mentioned community, I mean, I think one of the great successes of this first year has been, because there's so much interest in being involved in DPLA, we've been able to launch a community reps program where we have people from across the United States, and we're about to accept our second class of community reps. We took 100 people in January. We're about to take another 100 here now in late April as we're recording. So probably in May we'll be announcing this. But community reps, DPLA community reps, have applied from across the United States, and they act as our folks on the ground to help evangelize for the project. They hold events, hackathons to create new neat apps for the DPLA app library. They talk to students, K-12 students, college students about the DPLA and what they might be able to find there. Mm-hmm. And they help us to sort of think ahead and let everyone know about what we're doing. And so, again, it's a very gratifying part of being a part of this project is just the community involvement.
And you do have then a sort of mothership in Boston, though you have a very small footprint given what you've taken on here in terms of paid employees.
We do. We only have 8 paid employees. Yeah, I think people are really shocked. Whenever I give talks, I always end with a slide just showing the entire staff, and it often gets like gasps that we can do this much with so little. But one thing about this great community involvement is that we have so much help, and that we have, especially at our hubs across the United States, so much help in getting done what we need to get done. And I think that that's a big part of it. And also, I think there's pieces of modern technology that work in 2014 that really allow you to do a lot with a very little. I think if your audience is familiar with some of the apps that they probably use in their smartphone, that might be created by just a handful of people. And in some ways, we're the same thing. We have a very, very hardworking technical team, but it's very small, and we're able to do a lot with cloud services and modern internet infrastructure. So
Yeah.
it's a very exciting technical project as well.
Yeah, and an organizational project. Can you talk about your relationship with conventional public libraries, I wonder? Because I know when you started out, there were people who were anxious, you know, who love public libraries, that the DPLA, you know, might be impinging on them in some way.
Yeah, and I love public libraries. So do my kids. I mean, we are all, my entire family is a very, very heavy user of our local public library in Boston. And in fact, we reside in a public library. I'm talking to you from the bowels of the Boston Public Library in Copley Square in Boston. And we take the public part of our name extremely seriously. I think when people first heard about DPLA, they thought, oh, this is just going to be like a digital surrogate replacing the public library.
Yes.
And that's not at all, and I hope I've gotten across already, the fact that in a sense, we add this tremendous digital attic to the holdings of your public library. We have millions of unique pieces of material from all across the nation that lots of people are really interested in, amateur enthusiasts, family historians, anyone who's interested in really any topic can find materials in the DPLA, and it's all open access. So just like your public library, you can browse the stacks freely. You can take out whatever you want, in a sense, and get access to those materials. So it really opens up a giant library that adds on to your local public library. Having said that, right, there's some kinds of materials that we're unlikely to have in the DPLA anytime soon. The latest Stephen King novel is unlikely to be in the DPLA for various licensing reasons and things like that. So I think in some sense we're very complimentary with what's going on at your public library. Having said that, we also want to make common cause with public libraries. We have a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is helping us to do outreach to public libraries across the United States to help public librarians and their patrons learn digital skills and to participate in something like the DPLA. So we've just started those workshops this spring, and we're very excited about that pilot program that's going on, and we're doing that with our hubs. So I think public libraries are going to be a big part of what DPLA is doing. And we also know that in the long run, there are almost 17,000 branch libraries in the United States, many of them small and rural. And a lot of those places do have local historical collections that have not been seen outside of their local town or city.
Yeah,
and so our hope is that as part of this Gates training program that we can bring those collections online, because that's really unseen material that we'd love to share with the rest of the country and indeed with the world.
And in terms of your association with the schools, we had on the show earlier this year David Lankus, who teaches library science at Syracuse University, who essentially stated that librarians are in the education business, and he called us radical agents of positive change, which applies very much to what you're doing here, I think, you know, in that we facilitate education in our community. So the change here isn't necessarily technological change. It's a change that's imparted by education. And I wonder if you see yourself essentially in the education business here, and then is there a crossover between what you're doing and, say, school curricula?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think as the aggregation gets bigger and bigger, we're starting to sort of turn the giant DPLA ship directly in the direction of education, because it's really a critical use for our collection.
Yeah.
And what I would say, I think I agree 100%, the librarians who are involved have helped us to build actually is the most used part of our site, which are our curated exhibits, a lot of which are being used actually in classrooms because they're wonderful introductions using primary sources from the nation's collections of topics like the Civil Rights Movement, Great Depression, national parks, and environmentalism in the U.S. We have these exhibits because librarians who are part of the DPLA community have got together, have pulled out, let's say, a couple of dozen really compelling photographs or pieces of material culture that have been scanned in, and contextualized that for audiences. And then we have a special part of our site. If you go to our site at dp.la, in the upper right, you'll see those exhibitions. And a lot of people go straight there and then really like that kind of curated feel. And really the primary goal of that is to make these materials available for education at all levels. And we're looking to expand that. We have about 8 or 10 exhibits at the present time, but we'd really like to expand that out. And a lot of the folks who will be doing those exhibits, in fact, will be librarians, including public librarians. So we're very excited about that possibility. And in fact, the Gates grant that I just mentioned about reaching out to public libraries and public librarians, one of the big results out of that will be that there'll be a bunch of new exhibits that these public librarians will do with materials from their communities at the end of their training. So we're really excited about that possibility of using the collection for education.
Your aspirations here, you know, bringing all knowledge to all humanity, I think it's part of your mission statement there, isn't it? I have to say, are both captivating and exhilarating. And I think this has to do with what Robert Darnton, who we had on the show last week, is one of the motive forces behind the DPLA. He proclaimed at the project's outset, in the article that he wrote for the New York Review of Books to help launch the project, he associated this excitement with the project's utopian aspirations and with the highest ideals of the Age of Enlightenment, which is his field. And I wonder, is your brief here to promote universal access? And if so, if you're advocating then for an expansion of the public domain?
Well, the way I like to put it is we want to advocate for maximal access. Mm-hmm. And we are still operating within the law and within copyright law. And we know, as I mentioned with Stephen King's latest novel, that we can't have fully universal access to every bit of material, although I think, again, in combination with the wonderful community hubs that are public libraries and the physical holdings there of these more recent works like books that are still under copyright, we can achieve, in some sense, you know, close to universal access for all. But we do advocate for, you know, as much access as possible to as many materials as possible. And so I think that doing that, I think, requires us as a society to think anew about our information landscape and how we can make more materials available. Some of that will involve mass digitization. Some of it will involve, I would say, thinking about what has been largely sort of gray areas of the law where we're not quite sure what to do with things like what are called orphan works.
Yes,
books that have been published but whose authors and publishers are no longer around, but because of the incredible extent of default copyright law, they might not fall into the public domain until the 22nd century. And, you know, we need to think about what to do in those cases where we want to, again, provide maximal access. And I think about it as really a key part of citizenry and democracy in the United States is this principle that we do, in fact, provide as much access to as much knowledge as possible. So it's an important mission. You know, I was just at the New York Public Library for a meeting yesterday, and I was in the trustees room, and there's a wonderful quote from Thomas Jefferson saying that the key to everything, and obviously Jefferson being of the Enlightenment, is in fact access to knowledge and the light that access and that knowledge produces, and the illumination, I think, as he put it. And so I think pursuing Jefferson's dream is a really key part of what we're doing.
Of course, Jefferson was one of the founders of the Library of Congress. And I wonder, what is your relationship with these other great institutions that do work as portals, both the physical institutions like LC and, say, their American Memory Project, but also OCLC's WorldCat, for instance?
Yeah. Right. So obviously there are wonderful and in some cases much larger entities out there than little old us. You know, Library of Congress is a tremendous institution, has over 150 million physical and digital objects in its holdings. But I think LC is a bit different, and I hope I've gotten that across, than what we're doing, which is really surfacing and bringing together content from all across the United States and rather than the holdings of a single institution. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we love LC. We want LC's material to be part of what we're doing, and I think we're working toward ways of doing that, especially considering that a lot of their materials are, in fact, open access and public domain. You mentioned Chronicling America and American Memory, Chronicling America for newspapers, American Memory for photographs and other scanned material. WorldCat obviously provides metadata, but not the full digital versions of objects. And there's another kind of distinction. So WorldCat is this amazing union catalog of, I think, a billion objects around the world, which is great. We, as part of DPLA, only link out to materials that are fully publicly viewable. So we don't reference just a book on a shelf. We reference a digital copy of that book that you can, with one click from our site, go ahead and read. And I think, again, there's another distinction. So I think all these projects work together extremely well. You know, we are, again, a very highly collaborative project, and we look forward to collaboration with OCLC and LC.
The linking of systems must be part of what you do, since you're making this material accessible mainly. And I wonder, do you impose standards? You must work with standards. And I know the joke, you know, among librarians with standards is the great thing about standards is there's so many to choose from. And,
right. So we sure do. I mean, a big part of the value that we're adding to this ecosystem is the normalization of data to a single standard. And we do have a metadata standard, which, in fact, we borrowed from Europeana, which that project in Europe that I mentioned earlier, the Europeana data model. And so we normalize all this data. And I think one of the great things that we do is, in a sense, we've provided interoperability between all these many collections, all using a different standard and local standards and national standards. And we try to shoehorn all those different things into our metadata model. And once that's done, you can do amazing things, right? You can do new kinds of faceted searching and things that you couldn't do if you went to 1,300 different websites and tried to match up everything. So yes, standardization is really critical. And one of the nice things, again, is we have standardization between America and Europe with the two projects there, and also in Australia and New Zealand with projects that are similar to DPI and Europeana there as well, since we're all using, in some sense, interoperable data. So another important piece of the project.
Yeah. Names are often a lot more important than we realize sometimes when we take them on. And I wonder, will your taking on the metaphor of the public library to describe your project determine at all your content or the way you present your content? And would you be working differently, say, if you had called yourself the University Library of America or something else, MEMEX, say, or
yeah, right. A lot of people don't realize, and I think if we've had any criticism, perhaps this one that, you know, came out of universities, that it's all just university-driven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that only a quarter of our collection comes from university libraries.
Oh.
We had a great chart that was part of our first birthday celebration that I've been showing to folks, and the breakdown on that is remarkable because, you know, I think if people think about us as a university digital library, we're really not. We do have a lot of material from university libraries, but we have a lot from public libraries. We have a lot from museums. I think we have about 14% from museums, and so we have tens of thousands of works of art that have come in. We have materials from state, federal, and local government agencies. We have materials from independent libraries across the United States. We have materials from community colleges. We have, you know, materials from all levels of education and of cultural heritage, historical societies. So, I mean, it is a very, very diverse set of institutions that are involved. So I think in that way, we really have gone past some of this criticism about exactly what we are. And in fact, something like the Gates program that we're really invested in is a way to further expand that beyond, let's say, large institutional libraries.
Now, do you get attitudes from academics that because you call yourself a public library, that you're not really a serious research resource?
Right. So on the other side, I mean, in terms of research, I think it's really intriguing to look at our server logs, to look at how people are using our collection. We have obviously a lot of browsers. We have people who come in for, you know, to look for very specific targeted things. But we do have a lot of researchers use our collection. In fact, about 10% of the people who visit our site look at 20 items or more, which is, you know, a real signal that these people are doing pretty detailed research, mining our collection for specific things for an independent book or article or something like that. So what we want to do is be able to serve multiple audiences. I think we have a very attractive interface that's great for browsing, but it's also great for, you know, really digging in and getting down to item level kinds of descriptions.
Yeah, along those lines, you know, when I look at your interface there, the website, I see an unusual intelligence at work. You know, when I look at a lot of portals of different kinds in my work as a librarian, there's something elegant and genuinely creative about it in its presentation and graphic design, you know, in the tools you offer, in its conception and execution. For instance, I see imagination at work in your apps development resource there, and I see memory at work everywhere in your graphics, in the way the site deploys very old information models, such as a timeline, and your deployment of space and time tools, as well as a kind of thoughtful approach to the question of serendipity, which seems to come up as a theme in your site there.
Yeah.
Tells me about a philosophical mindset moving behind the scenes. And this isn't, by the way, the usual way of discovery tools in my experience, which tend to be sort of crude, inelegant, and generally lacking in anything resembling an arts and sciences sensibility. You know, they always strike me as kind of blunt corporate incursions into academic libraries and sort of clumsy approximations of scholarly apparatus. To be honest, I mean, I almost never send students to our discovery tools, which we pay a fortune for, by the way. So, you know, is this a matter of design, or is it just that you have thoughtful people working for you who obviously are readers and have some investment in the life of the mind?
And I should say, you know, I spent 20 years of my life as a professional historian.
Yes.
I'm quite used to those interfaces.
Yeah.
And I think design is important in 2014, and I think it can do a lot. I think it it relates to a couple of the principles that you mentioned in your overview of it. I think serendipity is a big part of it.
Yeah.
I talk a lot about serendipity and what our collection does. Standard, very technical search interfaces that are text-heavy often discourage or block certain kinds of serendipity. So we have, for instance, a way to browse our book collection that actually looks like a stack of books. They're sized appropriately. They're clustered in a way that can vary. So it's a sort of virtual bookshelf that can resort itself based on your interests and based on relevancy rankings and can show images that are related to those books. It's this thing called DPLA Bookshelf, which comes from this great project that David Weinberger and others at a library innovation lab at Harvard put together, a project called Stack Life, which we mm-hmm. have repurposed. But that provides a great kind of visual serendipity where you kind of bump into other things. And I think members of your audience who've done academic research know that a lot of what you do is, in fact, I mean, the things that you've picked up on are bumped into at
yes.
a special collection or on the shelf. And so we've tried to create an environment. I think the map is another good example of this, where you can literally bump into different kinds of things. And I think that's really critical. I think it's also critical that it's different kinds of item types. Usually when you're looking for text, you only find text, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking in an academic database, it will just give you matching articles. What we can do in our interface is, yes, provide you with some matching textual information, but side by side with that, we might find some photographs that might also interest you, and then you might end up using those as well in your research. So I think serendipity is a big part of it. I also think audience segmentation through design is very important.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been involved in a lot of big digital projects that make assumptions about the kinds of audiences that are involved. And one key principle of design is, in fact, to have certain people in your audience go one way and have others go other ways.
Yeah.
So you often see this in a kind of researcher's interface, which is probably going to be beige and very text-heavy, and then a kind of populist interface, which might be brighter colors. But we try to do that, I think, in a savvier way, which is that, yes, there's a kind of Google-style single search box, and if you know what you're doing, you can use Boolean searches and ands and ors, and then do faceted searches to kind of narrow down your research. But there are also ways in that allow you to prospect a little bit more fluidly, like the timeline, where you can spin back and forth through time and pull out little bar charts of what's available in that area. So I think one of the big innovations that we can make is to provide new kinds of search interfaces to these kinds of research collections.
We're talking on the show last year with Tom Warger. He's an academic computing consultant who actually worked here at one time with us as a consultant, and then he was acting director of our computing program at Vassar. And he talked about various problems that computer center directors are up against that he's noticed over time, and I've noticed this too. And one of the great problems with media projects of any kind is the problem of sustainability. Many great ideas and great projects gather momentum and adherence only to suddenly evaporate when the initial grant funding runs out, or people leave the organization to go on to other things and take their vision along with them. So I wonder, do you think about sustainability, and how do you see the project being carried on years down the road when you and your staff are gone? In other words, is the DPLA, metaphorically speaking, do you think of it as an edifice founded on a rock and built to last the ages, which it may very well do, you know, it may be here 200 years from now, or is it instead a kind of mobile nomadic encampment on the shifting sands of the digital information age?
Well, I like to think that we're built for the long run, and mm-hmm. I think about sustainability quite a bit since I'm executive director, and so it's really incumbent upon me to build a sustainable organization,
yeah.
And there's a few reasons I think people can feel confident we'll be around. I think, first of all, the idea is so compelling. It's something that I think people have wanted to do for a really long time. Now it's here. We're actually live. We exist. We've pulled together and tripled in the last year our collection, and so there's a lot of stakeholders and buy-in across the nation, again, over 1,300 institutions involved. So there's a lot of buy-in, and I think the model is also a very sustainable one, one that doesn't involve thousands of people in the headquarters of a company or a very large nonprofit. We're a very small, lightweight organization that can rely on a national network that is part of what we're doing. So that is a big part of it as well. And we've gotten, you know, tremendous, incredible support from philanthropists, from funders, both public and private. The Sloan Foundation, for Peace Sloan Foundation, which is our lead funder, was really so critical. And now we've had, as I mentioned, Gates, we've had Mellon Foundation, we've had the Knight Foundation provide really enormous help for what we're doing. And then we have, beyond those great private funders, we have public funders like the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Institute for Museum and Library Services. So we have had a tremendous amount of support. You know, having said that, we are looking to build a very sustainable, supportable model. We don't cost a lot of money each year to run, but we're looking at various models for doing that. And in fact, the grant that we got from the Mellon Foundation is specifically targeted toward helping us reach sustainability in the next couple of years.
Is Europeana, European Union funded and administered thing? Yeah, it is. So, and Gallica then too is, you know, the great French information portal.
Right.
Ordinarily, you know, this kind of sweeping public education endeavor would take place in a governmental framework. And as I said, LC would have been the, you know, the logical institution where this might have been developed. But I wonder if you can talk about the positives and negatives of doing this on your own as opposed to doing it under the wing of the federal government. And of course, libraries in this country have always benefited with private benefactors, beginning, of course, with Carnegie. So the question is there a good side of being on your own, and is there a bad side of not having zillions of dollars behind you? So,
Right. Well, I should say, let me answer the second question first, which is we would love more federal funding. And I think we've, now that we're established and I think we're doing quite well, I do think that we are worthy of a little bit of extra investment from the federal government. I think that could be a mix of agencies that are involved. But again, at the end of the day, we're a relatively cheap date. And so we're doing a lot nationally to bring this together. So I can see that being a good outcome. Yeah. Now, back to your first question, I think, you know, part of the advantage of being an independent 501c3 charitable organization is that we're incredibly nimble. We can do things like the design that you applauded really came out of really rapid development. Actually, all the development that we do is incredibly rapid development, where we're turning around changes to the site and enhancements all the time.
Yeah.
And so that's what a small organization can do. I think it's not even like a government versus non-government sort of thing. It's what small organizations where we have a really, I think, a very talented, creative staff and extremely hardworking for the eight of us to get things done. And that just allows us to do some things very quickly that would be hard to do on a kind of mass government or commercial scale.
So last question, is there anything my colleagues in the library world can do at this juncture to help the project along or make a contribution? And maybe more importantly, is there anything the ordinary public can do?
Sure. There's so many ways to get involved in the DPLA. I think for librarians, we are a network of librarians, as well as archivists and museum professionals and cultural heritage professionals. But there are lots of ways to get very deeply involved if you are interested. We do have committees and open calls every month, actually twice a month, but there are open board calls where anyone from the general public or from the library community can get involved. They're on specific topics, so we have them on legal issues, like we discussed copyright briefly. So we have a legal call every 3 months. We have one on outreach to communities. We have another one on technical issues. So if you're really interested in the tech side of DPLA, you can participate in that. And we have one on content, which talks about what are the kinds of things that we're missing? Where should we go next? What's going on with our overall content strategy? So we have those four committees, and anyone from the library world or from the general public can participate, and we really do encourage that. There are dozens of people who are on those calls every month, and we're really excited about that kind of participation. I mentioned the Community Reps Program, and that's another great way for people to get involved. dp.la/reps would be the place to hear about that, and that's a place for anyone. And really, we have a lot of librarians who are reps, but we also have a lot of people just from the general public who really love what we're doing and want to let other people know about it. And so you can become a rep in your community. We send you all kinds of awesome stuff, t-shirts and stickers and bookmarks and all kinds of swag. I think we have coffee mugs and water bottles and things like that. So fun things, but also things that you can do, again, events that you can hold in your community that would be DPLA related. So that's another big way to get involved. And then I think in general, you know, we are trying to aggregate as much content as we can and provide maximal access. And so I think for an institution that holds materials, you can get in touch. We have a section of our site which is for new partners and how they can add materials to our growing database. And I think that those who do add content feel that they have a great outcome because of that. We've had most of our partners talk about a huge surge in traffic from joining the DPLA. Mountain West Digital Library, for instance, based in Utah, more than doubled their traffic when they join the DPLA. So I think you'll see a lot of benefits for your organization as well.
Yeah, great. So this is great. It's utopian and practical, as Bob Darton said in that initial article when he talked about your aspirations. So I'd like to thank you, Dan, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today to talk about the DPLA.
Thanks so much. It's been great being on the show.
Yeah, it's been great having you. Thanks.